Welcome, listeners, to the second episode of Standing Post. We have a big show this month, but before I begin, I want to say thank you for subscribing to us. We here at Standing Post listened to your feedback and made some changes to the show. This month, you may hear a difference in audio quality during the podcast. Our partners at the Forensic Services Division, or FSD, upgraded our equipment, so I won't sound so far away from the microphone this time. We will continue working on improvements so you have a better listening experience with our podcast. The other request was to mention a little bit more about my history, which I will do through my interviews. Now, for this month's episode. Since the 1990s, the Secret Service has pioneered the field of threat assessment by conducting research on the targeting of public officials and figures, and establishing a model for investigating threat cases. This month's Standing Post guest is Dr. Lena Althari, who is the chief of the National Threat Assessment Center, or NTAC, which is under the Protective Intelligence and Assessment Division, or PID. The center's responsibility is to address school safety and the prevention of targeted violence. So please welcome to Standing Post, Dr. Lena Althari. Dr. Lena Althari, thank you for joining us today for this episode of Standing Post. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
I'm happy to have you here and to have you come talk to us about where you come from and how you arrived here at the Secret Service.
Sure, absolutely. So I've been with the Secret Service for close to 11 years now. This is my 11th year. For the majority of the time here, I was with the National Threat Assessment Center, which I'll talk about in a few seconds. But prior to joining the agency, I worked for 8 years at a psychiatric hospital in Northern Virginia. It's a state inpatient facility for the state of Virginia. In that setting, I worked as a psych tech when I started, but then I moved on to become a behavior analyst and run the behavior support team. And I did that until 2006, which is when I joined the agency. That previous job entailed coming up with positive behavior supports for patients who may be experiencing distress, engaging in maladaptive behavior, such as aggression. It's usually a product of their illness. And so you're trying to assess and see what is driving the maladaptive behavior that the patient is engaging in, and how can we put supports in place to decrease that. So I did that for a few years, and my degree was more research-focused. So I decided I wanted to change and really see how can my research help with the behavior analysis portion. So I did a job search, and out popped this Secret Service job where they wanted a research psychologist working in a threat assessment center. What this center did was translate research operationally so that we can go out and train on behaviors. So it was really the perfect fit in terms of my career path as well as education.
Your position within the Secret Service actually falls within kind of a special area that I don't think a lot of listeners know about. We have the special agent, we have the uniform division, and then we have the administrative, professional, and technical position, or APT, within the organization. Would you like to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely. So just to give you an idea of specifically the positions within the National Threat Assessment Center. So I'm the chief of the center, which is the supervisory research psychologist. Our staff are what we call social science research specialists, and they come from a variety of backgrounds in terms of academically and experience. Some have masters, some have PhDs, some have worked in universities, others have worked in research centers, or even other federal or state agencies. And so, as you've mentioned, the agency has agents, which are the law enforcement, as well as the uniform division officers, who are also law enforcement. For the administrative, professional, technical, that could be several job series. We have analysts. Those are intelligence research specialists. We also have criminal research specialists. So various terms of analyst positions, or researcher positions. So it's a lot of times I think people in the community just associate the agency with the agents and the uniform division officers because that's the public face of the agency and that's what they see. But there are a lot of other opportunities in terms of positions within the agency that are not law enforcement, like mine, like our researchers and analysts and human resource specialists and others within the agency.
finishing your work with the Mental Health Institute, when you came across the U.S. Secret Service's job page, what did you find there, and why did you feel that at that time it matched your job?
Right. So when I did the search, I used keywords, you know, back then. It was quite a while ago. We didn't have the same technology that we do now in job searching, so it took a bit longer. But I was looking for research psychology positions, but really that also had a direct impact on the community in terms of assisting the public. My previous work with the Mental Health Institute was directly working with patients. So while I wanted a research position, I wanted to still be able to interact with the community to see the impact of the research. So I entered the terms research psychology and behavior assessment, and this position was for a research psychologist with the Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center. And when I did more research on the center by going to the website and seeing what kind of research they'd done, I was actually quite surprised because I had not realized you have a certain impression of the Secret Service and what they do, and I did not realize that this branch existed within the service where they're studying various forms of targeted violence, and then translating that research operationally to go out and do training for police, for other public safety partners on prevention. So that really spoke to me, because you're taking the research aspect and then you're translating it and you're directly impacting the work of safety professionals in the community.
Now, were you able to make that translation back to the Mental Health Institute, or were you just looking for something new, a step up to be able to?
I think I was looking for something new, but I also realized there'd be a mental health component to it, because a lot of the people that the Secret Service deal with sometimes do have mental health issues. They think they have a relationship with the president, or they feel like they have important information to give to the president. So I knew there'd be a lot of overlap as well in terms of mental health. And one of the aspects that I liked about it is when we're studying these type of attacks, one of the things that you look at is what influenced the person. And rarely is it mental health, but mental health is a component in terms of what the agency has to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And so how to work to include training material, NTAC was doing that for the agency in terms of the agency uniform division officers, how to interact with those with mental illness, how to interview them, what kind of questions to ask to get that person the care that they need.
Is there any specific case comes to mind that might be able to provide the listeners to kind of give them an idea about what a day would be like for you working with NTAC?
We're researchers, so our day is basically sitting in front of the computer and researching different sites, doing literature reviews, researching cases, writing materials. So the day-to-day aspect of NTAC can be quite tedious in terms of the details you have to pay attention to, but it's not exciting, let's just put it that way. No one would say research is super exciting. However, keeping in mind the goal of that research, so a big aspect of what we do is we provide training to external communities. So we travel all over the country doing trainings for federal and state and local law enforcement, mental health professionals, school personnel, counselors, on how to prevent these type of attacks in the community. So that part of it is really exciting, because you're actually seeing the results of your research impacting the people that actually need it the most, which is our public safety partners.
So you mentioned training. Is there some examples you can provide maybe in the training that helps translate that research that you've done behind the computer, doing the literature reviews and doing your research, and then actually implementing it out into the field and actually seeing outcomes being created?
So just to give you and the listeners a background on the center, the National Threat Assessment Center has a congressional authorization for our mission. And the mission is to conduct research on various types of targeted violence. And by targeted violence, I mean when a person or group intentionally selects a specific target for attack in line with some motive that they have, unrelated to criminal or spontaneous violence. So we conduct research on that type of violence because we want to be able to understand why it occurs and how to prevent it. The second mission is to do training on prevention based on the science that we learn from the research. We do also consultations for agencies building threat assessment units and sometimes specific threat cases as well. Also that we can promote this sort of standardization of how the community does threat assessment. And threat assessment is the process by which you are identifying people who might be in distress or engaging in concerning behavior, gathering information to assess the risk they pose for violence, and if you decide they do pose a risk, then coming up with mitigation strategies. That's essentially what a threat assessment process is. So a lot of the training that we do is to translate that research into operations. One of the biggest ones that we've been doing since really about 2000, the agency had done a research study called the Safe School Initiative, in which they studied 37 incidents of attacks on K through 12 schools. This happened after Columbine. We approached the Department of Education and offered this partnership. That study really set the standard for threat assessments in schools, and that continues to be the case today. So a lot of the training that we do, and unfortunately, especially following high-profile incidents of school violence, our training quests go up, is to go out and do trainings for schools. So one of the ones we just did, in fact, recently, I believe it was in Kansas City, we had 700 audience members that were comprised of school teachers, administrators, counselors, mental health professionals, as well as local law enforcement on how to establish threat assessment programs in schools so that we can prevent these incidents from happening or enhance our prevention efforts, school safety.
Dr. Al-Atharia, you've been able to take this research and you've been able to take it into more of an operational tone, take it from operations into training and being able to provide like a tangible training opportunity to the community regarding threats that could be in public spaces. Can you let the listeners know maybe some things that you've learned in that process and maybe provide them some takeaways that they might be able to use?
We're always learning from the research and these incidents. So what I usually tell our audience members when we are doing these trainings is that there are always opportunities for prevention. And one of the biggest things that we see is that and encourage in the community is early intervention. Based on the findings of our research, we see that a lot of times these individuals who have engaged in these types of attacks, and in addition to the school ones, as you mentioned, there's been other attacks, obviously, in public spaces, whether attacks against houses of worship, workplaces in the form of an employee engaging in workplace violence against the workplace, just attacks in the community on events, monuments, landmarks, attractions, and other public spaces. What we see when we study the backgrounds of these offenders that in a majority of these cases, these people had elicited concern in those around them, whether it's family, neighbors, coworkers, or other members of the community. And sometimes this behavior, the concerning behavior that they engaged in, occurred even months, years prior to their attack, which for us offers opportunities for intervention. So if some of the behaviors that we see that elicited concern was dramatic or sudden changes in behavior, whether it's a student in terms of academic performance, acting in a more depressive manner, withdrawal, isolation, maybe making comments about past school shooters or incidents of violence, having an inappropriate interest in these types of attacks, those are some of the behaviors that we've seen, particularly for students. This sudden change, turning in assignments maybe that are concerning in tone and making these kind of statements. So that's always important for us to highlight because we want schools and other community partners to be able to identify these behaviors and start putting in interventions in place to address that behavior. So if a student expressing depressive or suicidal ideation, then maybe getting them counseling, working with the parent, getting them access to treatment. If the student is engaging in behavior that is more concerning in terms of talking about violence or risk for violence, maybe talking to the student, talking to the family to be able to find out why is the student engaging in this behavior and what can we do to help them or change that trajectory of that behavior so that we can intervene early before someone even thinks about violence as an option. And we've seen that in other types of attacks as well. In a majority of those cases, not only did they elicit concern in those around them, but one of the biggest things we find is that majority of these individuals had experienced a significant stressor that impacted them, specifically even in the year leading up to their attack. So that's something to look for. If we are concerned about an individual, if you in the community is concerned about an individual, then what can you look for to be able to see if that person is a risk? Have they engaged in these behaviors? Have they shown inappropriate interest? Are they communicating about a grievance that they have, maybe with the workplace or a certain target? And have they had any significant stressors? Those usually come in the form of family or romantic relationships going wrong, divorces, breakups, things like that, someone losing a job, financial difficulty. We released a report looking at mass attacks in public spaces in 2017, that occurred in 2017. We've released that report this year in March. And one of the biggest things we saw that in over 50% of those cases, the people had experienced significant financial instability leading up to their attack, as well as engaging in concerning behavior that elicited alarm in those around them.
Now, does your research and the information that you provide on the U.S. Secret Service website, does it provide a list of those significant life events that you've identified that people can see and kind of look at and say, okay, I've recognized this into certain individuals' behaviors, or these I know have experienced, maybe I should do something?
So all of our reports, and I keep talking about research reports, and sometimes people, you know, their eyes glaze over when I say that, but really is they are operational reports. They really are written in the, from our perspective for the public so that they can be able to understand what is it exactly do I look for and what can I do about it. I think what we see in the majority of these cases, people realize that that person is experiencing distress, but a lot of times they don't know what to do with this information. So if someone is engaging in certain behavior, they may not be so blatantly obvious that it's indicative of violence. So obviously if someone brings a weapon to school or someone is actually making a direct threat, that's pretty obvious. You know, that's concerning. I'm going to call the police or I'm going to let management or the school officials know. But if someone is engaging in these lower-level behaviors, we call them, such as the changes in behavior, the depressive symptoms, the starting to talk in terms of inappropriate interest, sometimes people think, yes, this is off, but I don't know what to do about it. And so that's what we do in our reports. We highlight the behaviors and then offer what where people can go.
Could you kind of walk us through or talk about that a little bit?
As I said, not many people know that the National Threat Assessment Center exists within the Secret Service because of the really important work that the agency did in regards to school safety, such as the Safe School Initiative. Sometimes when there are high-profile events and people Google or research threat assessment or targeted violence or school shootings, our center is usually one of the first hits that pops up on those type of searches. And so we try to make our website accessible so that people know how to find the reports and how to look for them. Another way that we disseminate this information, I think in recent years we've been doing it more and more as an agency in terms of working with our partners to get this information out, because I think everyone in this agency realizes the importance of prevention. That is our number one mission as an agency, and so we want to be able to make that available to our public safety partners. So we do a lot of work in terms of disseminating the information on these reports. So for example, the mass attacks report that we released in March of this year, we worked with the Department of Homeland Security. Several of the offices there have stakeholders that they distribute information to. So one of those, for example, is the Office of State and Local Law Enforcement. They have a listserv of major police agencies and law enforcement executives through the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the major cities chiefs of police associations. So they actually distributed our report through that. We've also worked with our partners when we released Safe School Initiative, the Department of Education. We did follow-up studies looking at attacks on institutions of higher education. Again, press releases, releasing it to the community so that we make sure the people that want these reports are getting them. And I think because of all those efforts that the agency has put behind this research and support of the National Threat Assessment Center, we've been getting more people reaching out to us because of that. One of the biggest ways that the community can access this training, which, by the way, is paid for by the agency, so when we go out and do the trainings, there is no cost incurred to the community unless someone has to get a venue or something like that. But for in terms of our staff traveling to do the training, our agency is supportive of that and provides the funding for that. But if anyone wants a training from the National Threat Assessment Center, whether it's on preventing targeted school violence or for law enforcement agencies preventing attacks in the community, then they usually go through our field offices all over the country.
And we'll provide a way for listeners to be able to do that.
Right, absolutely.
Have you seen any positive outcomes through your training in the community?
I will tell you about one incident that occurred even before my time with this agency, because it's quite significant as to how important getting the information out on threat assessment and how to establish threat assessment programs in the community so that we can identify individuals who might be experiencing distress early in terms of prevention. After the Safe School Initiative was released, One police chief later talked to the media about this, that they actually had an incident that was averted in their community. And this was, I believe, in New Bedford, Connecticut. And the school district there, the school there, as well as the police department, had actually already initiated establishing threat assessment protocols in place based on the findings of the Safe School Initiative. So this was immediately after it was released. So they were already in the process of establishing a program in their school, as well as working with the local police department, which is one of the recommendations of the Safe School Initiative, is to work with local law enforcement because they're normally the school resource officers. And they had an incident occur in which a student received phone calls at the time from a friend who was, I believe it was phone calls or text messages, so I'm sorry, I don't remember quite the details, but from a friend who talked about carrying out a school attack. And she was very concerned. She thought maybe he was joking, but then she felt concerned enough that she actually reported it to a school official that she felt very comfortable with. And that person immediately started working with law enforcement. And because they actually had this relationship and they already had these assessment protocols in place, they were actually able to avert a school attack. So that was an direct impact of when this study, the Safe School Initiative, was released, to the community actually being able to prevent an incident that could have been quite tragic. So that was back then, that was when the study was first released. More recently, just in terms of one of the things that we do at the National Threat Assessment Center, when we travel and do training for schools as well as law enforcement, we do what we call these outreach meetings. We schedule meetings with local police departments and local schools just so we can identify best practices, what are some of the challenges they deal with. And we've actually learned a lot from these meetings. And in terms of the sophistication of threat assessment protocols in the community, it really runs the gamut. Some schools don't have the resources to be able to do that, but they're trying to establish protocols in place. Other schools have received more resources and they have quite sophisticated programs in place. It really runs the gamut. But I think everyone realizes the importance of having some type of capabilities in place within the school so that they can be able to identify these students, get them the help they need before they even think of violence as an option.
Are relationships a big thing with training? Your example with the student going to the official, is it one of those things in the training that you're talking about, building relationships within the public space?
Absolutely. One of the biggest aspects of our training is how to encourage information sharing in the community, whether it's between parents and school officials, schools and law enforcement, school teachers and guidance counselors. Really, it's all about sharing information, obviously keeping in mind any federal or state statutes or rules. However, there is a lot of information that can be shared, all in terms of trying to get that person help. So one of the biggest things that we talk about in training is to gather information from multiple sources. We call it using community systems contacts. So for example, for us as an agency, when someone comes to our attention who might be exhibiting an inappropriate or threatening interest in one of our protected interests, whether it's the president, it's a facility that we protect, we're going to go out and do an interview with that person, but we're also going to be reaching out to the people around them, whether it's family members, neighbors, coworkers, to be able to get an accurate picture of that person over time, to find out why are they engaging in this behavior that brought them to our attention? Are they experiencing any significant stressors? Have they engaged in behavior that was concerning to the people around them? Also, that we can identify, A, why that person engaged in that behavior, and B, how can we get them the help they need, whether it's the assistance of their family or social services or mental health services, to get that person the help they need. And we do similar things in terms of encouraging schools, setting up programs in place. One of the biggest things that a school needs to do is establish a threat assessment team. And in terms of establishing threat assessment protocols, that team should be multidisciplinary. So you should have a teacher, you should have a school principal, school resource officers, counselors, mental health professionals, all so that you can share information from a multidisciplinary perspective to be able to assess that person and then identify intervention strategies.
Dr. Al-Athari, back on July 12th, you and your organization released an operational guide, Enhancing School Safety Using a Threat Assessment Model, an operational guide for preventing targeted school violence on the website. Would you like to explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. So just to give a background on what's been going on this year, as I've said already that the agency has done research on multiple types of targeted violence beginning back in the late 1990s. And one of the biggest studies we've done was the Safe School Initiative that looked at school shooters following the incident at Columbine. Similarly, this year, after the tragic incident in Parkland, Florida at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the agency redoubled its commitment to preventing school violence. So we've launched several projects in relation to school safety. The first was the creation of this guide that's based on our years of research and collecting incidents and going out and doing training on school prevention. The purpose of the guide is to provide schools with actionable steps that they can take to identify students who might be experiencing distress or of concern, engaging in concerning behavior, gathering information to assess the risk that student may pose for engaging in a harmful act against the school or themselves, and then coming up with intervention strategies to mitigate that risk. This guide spells it out. It's how to establish threat assessment programs in schools, beginning with establishing a threat assessment team, creating central reporting mechanisms, establishing threshold for notifying law enforcement, coming up with intervention strategies, and so on. So that was the first project this year in response to not only our agency's school safety efforts, but also the Department of Homeland Security. They had created a committee that also looks at school security, and one of the components on that committee is the Secret Service. The reason that we did this is not only because our agency wanted to redouble its commitment to preventing school violence and community safety, but also because the Department of Homeland Security has initiated efforts as well in response to the Parkland tragedy. And so they have a committee that is comprised of the multiple components, one of which is the Secret Service. So our deliverable projects for those committee that will feed into the Federal Commission on School Safety that was established by the administration is to release this guide, as well as conducting a new research project looking at incidents in which a current or recently former student targeted a K-12 school for an attack. It's basically an update to what the agency has done years ago. We'll be looking at more recent incidents of school attacks and releasing that in the spring of next year.
So is this one of those products that have come out of your research, what you operationalized, and now this
Absolutely.
Becomes a tangible item that individuals can come
in? Absolutely. Okay. So the guide is published on the website. Hard copies are being printed and will be distributed to school districts throughout the country. It's available if anyone in the community wants the guide. They can just go on the secretservice.gov website, look for the National Threat Assessment Center, and it will be posted on there and available for school resource officers, community members, teachers, counselors, you know, anyone with a stake in terms of preventing school violence. And the research study will be, again, operationalized and released on the agency's website. So following the tragedy at Parkland, obviously that had such a deep impact on the nation as a whole that the federal government, across several components, are really looking at what they can do to assist the community in preventing these kind of incidents. As I talked earlier about the Department of Homeland Security's response to school security efforts, the Federal Commission on School Safety that's been established, one of the things that I had to participate in was the Senate Judiciary Committee holding a hearing on Parkland oversight, but also as well as school safety sort of solutions. What are some of the best practices out there in terms of being able to prevent these kind of incidents? So my participation on that panel was to discuss the National Threat Assessment Center's work in terms of threat assessment and research on the prevention of targeted violence and how that impacts specifically the school community. So I talked about the effectiveness of establishing threat assessment programs in schools to be able to identify students who are experiencing distress or engaging in behavior that concerned others and how to provide them with the resources that they need to be able to prevent future incidents of targeted attacks.
Dr. Althari, it was amazing to have you here. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the listeners?
Thank you for having me, Cody. We are always excited to talk about the work that the Secret Service does in the field of prevention and threat assessment. As we said before, not many people are familiar with the center and the fact that the agency allocates resources to support prevention efforts in the community, these type of resources, I should say. We work very closely with our field office agents all over the country in terms of being able to give back to the community and provide training sponsored by the agency so that we can all have a role in preventing these types of attacks.
Thank you for standing post with us. We're grateful for your listenership as we continue on our journey to learn more about the Secret Service. We'd like to mention to you, due to the hard work of Dr. Althar and her team at NTAC, that a bipartisan group of senators, led by Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, introduced the EAGLES Act of 2018. The EAGLES Act reauthorizes and expands the role of the Secret Service's National Threat Assessment Center. This act allows for the NTAC to continue the research into the causes of targeted violence and pre-attack indicators. Next month, we will talk to Special Agent Matthew O'Neill, who runs the Global Investigative Operations Center, or GIOC. He plays a critical role in taking down criminals involved in cyber and financial crimes. So subscribe today and tune in for this great interview on Apple iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Until then, listeners, stay vigilant.